Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas on Friday, February the 22nd, day number 53 of 2013. And like we do on Fridays, we'll be chatting with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe, and we're going to be talking about the American economy and what's going on out there in the American economy. Obviously, every week we have a new surprise about Obamacare, something that they didn't anticipate, such as higher prices. Somehow they didn't anticipate that one. So we'll be chatting with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe. As I've said many times, she's my favorite economist, and that's because she can explain these issues, very complicated issues that they are. She can explain them in a very, very nice, easy way to understand. So if you're like me, you know, I'm when it comes to economics, I like things to be simple, and she has a way of making them simple, which is one of the reasons why we enjoy chatting with her on Fridays. You know, I wish she had been my economics teacher. I keep thinking about that, you know. What if I had had a teacher like Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe? I probably would have been more knowledgeable of economics. I think so. But anyway, we'll be chatting with her in just a minute here as we talk about this day in history. And I'm going to be getting into that as well. Of course, this is George Washington's birthday, and every schoolboy in the country needs to know that. You know, when I first came to the United States, we used to celebrate Washington's birthday and Lincoln's birthday. So I don't know why we don't do that anymore. We used to celebrate them separately, and now we celebrate them as one president day. But I think it takes away something from the greatness of President Washington when you celebrate his birthday along with everybody else. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the other men, of course, who've been president of the United States, but there's something special about George Washington, and we celebrate that today. Our sponsor today, Cubanos in Wisconsin. This is the book that I wrote about our family coming to the United States. I like to think of it as a book about family and freedom. That's what I'm getting from many of the reviews. They're telling me that they like the story because it's the story of a family. That was the whole idea. I wanted to introduce you to my whole family through this book and how we left Cuba and we ended up in Wisconsin. It's a story about family and freedom, and we now have it in Kindle, you know. A lot of you like Kindle. I kind of like print because I kind of like holding the book. But a lot of you are technical people. You're like my sons. You know, they want the Kindle. Well, we got that now. We got the Kindle as well as the print. And you can get them on Amazon directly from Amazon. And there's a link in the show information about the book. We're going to take a break and we'll be back with Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe right after this. Let us say hello to Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe. How are you?
Hello, Silvio. Happy Friday. I'm wonderful. Thank you. How about you?
Doing great. You know, you probably didn't hear this. I don't know whether you were listening to me when I said this, but I said I wish you had been my economics teacher.
Thank you. Thank you.
Then I would have probably learned a few things.
Well, probably so. I certainly would not have taught you communist economics, that's for sure.
Well, that's my point. You would have taught me the right thing about capitalism. Of course, I forgot to say this. I apologize to I forgot to say this. I had it written down. I forgot to say it. Thank you to the management of Blog Talk Radio for featuring our program today. Thank you very much for that. You know, but I was talking about this day, February the 22nd, that we have you on the air, but this is also George Washington's birthday, and I think this is a day that, you know, I don't have kids in school anymore, but when I was in school, this was a big day. We used to celebrate George Washington's birthday, and would tell stories about George Washington. I still think he's the most amazing of all the, you know, the great founding fathers, and he was amazing because he was the father of the country, I think, but also because something he did at the very end of his career where he walked away from the presidency and said, you know what, I'm done, let somebody else be president. I think that more than anything else, legitimized the Constitution. So that may have been his greatest act, you know, the way he left the stage.
He was a wonderful man. All you have to do is go see his estate, Mount Vernon. It was a wonderful enterprise in agriculture. He was a truly Renaissance man, equals, in my opinion, to Thomas Jefferson.
Entrepreneurship. Yeah, another citizen of Virginia, too, Thomas Jefferson. That's one of the good things about being in Virginia, that you're not far from some of these places, Mount Vernon, not far from Washington, D.C., and, of course, Monticello, not far either, where Jefferson's home is. But I just
It's wonderful. I'm writing an article about Thomas Jefferson's Monticello from the standpoint of his agricultural endeavors, which were transformational for the future of agriculture in Virginia and in the whole future United States. He was a remarkable man as well.
And I love that. I love that word Monticello. I guess that means mountain in the sky, right?
In the sky, because the estate is on top of a hill, and it's very secluded by vegetation. You can't actually see it from the bottom of the hill. And on days when it's really raining and thundering, you can't go up because they've had several lightning strikes. But then, during those times, people were not afraid of that. So
no, and you know, one thing about George Washington that you know, you always learn something about George Washington when you look back at his birthday and you read something here and there. But something I loved about him is that in his will, he simply said, "George Washington, citizen of the United States." And when you think of the narcissist that we have in the White House right now, what a comparison! You know, here is the greatest of all Americans, simply said, "I'm a citizen." I don't know. I just find that amazing.
I agree.
Yeah, amazing. George Washington. And as I was saying in the introduction, I wish we would go back to celebrate George Washington. I'm not saying we should have another holiday because we got plenty of those. But I'm simply saying that maybe we should have a holiday, although not necessarily shutting down government offices or whatever, but having a holiday for George Washington where we would literally celebrate his birthday. Of course, the other big thing that happened on this day in history, and I don't know whether you were living in the United States, maybe you had just gotten here, I believe. 1980, were you in the United States in 1980?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, on this day in 1980, the United States beat the all-USSR hockey team.
I remember that.
Lake Placid, New York. That was where they played. And that was the old Soviet team that, you know, I have to confess, you know, their jerseys said CCCP.
Right.
What did that mean? In Russian, was that the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics? Is that what that
meant?
Yes.
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And how did you say it in Russian? Do you remember?
I'm not sure. I think it's socialistische. I'm not sure. It's been a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, but anyway,
it's been a long time.
It was
I
so
try
funny.
To put that part in the back of my mind, because when you suffer so much under a regime, you try to block it from
right.
your memory unless you have to recall it. And
I understand.
The C in Russian is an actual S.
Oh, okay.
And P is the R in the Cyrillic alphabet. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it was just interesting because, you know, you would be playing the USSR and it would say CCCP and you were trying to figure out what that meant. But anyway, the United States beat the USSR.
I don't remember.
That's okay. We're not going to test your Russian today. We're not going to put you to the test on your Russian. You did pretty well with Monticello, so that you passed the test. But
I did.
But anyway, I'm just saying. I whenever I would see you know, the Russians and they would say CCCP, I was always intrigued, you know, as to what that meant. But anyway, the United States beat the USSR today in that big game, 4-3. But that didn't win the gold medal. A lot of people mistake it. It was not the gold medal that was decided in that game. That game was the semifinal to the gold medal game, and then the United States beat Sweden in the gold medal game. So, you know,
oh,
anyway.
It just came to me. Okay, since you put me on the spot, it
all
just
right.
came to me. I think the first C stood for Soyuz, and the second one for Sovietsky. And the third C stood for Sozialistische, and Respublik was the P. Yeah.
All right. Well, there you have it, our Russian lesson of the week.
Yeah.
We're going to make you into an honorary Russian today.
Ugh, please don't. Please don't.
Hey. Well, yeah, you don't need to do that. I don't know. I'm just teasing you. But this was, I remember this day when the United States beat the old Soviet team, and it was a lot of fun because, it was really the United States was the underdog. They were basically college kids playing against, the best, probably one, maybe not the best because there were professional hockey teams that were pretty good, but obviously, certainly in the amateur rank, they were the best team in the world. And to see the United States beat them, it was a lot of fun. So you were living here then when that was happening?
Yes, I was, and I've actually watched it because it was one of the few games I could actually understand hockey and basketball. I couldn't understand American football or baseball. Those were totally alien to me.
Right, right. And they played a lot of hockey in Romania? Just curious.
They played some. I wouldn't say a lot. They played mostly soccer, basketball, handball, volleyball.
Hmm. Okay, I didn't realize that Romania played a lot of hockey. I know soccer, yes, but I didn't.
Some,
know.
Not a lot, but
not
some,
a lot,
yeah.
But anyway, so tell me about your book. How's your book doing?
Well, it's still at the bestseller at Amazon, but I'm definitely behind Al Gore and definitely behind Thomas Friedman. So that's kind of upsetting that there are more liberals reading about the global warming drivel than there are conservatives reading about the realities of UN Agenda 21. But I had an interesting presentation this week here in Fairfax County to a large group, and we had a lot of people from the other side who were there, and they received it quite well. There were a few, of course, space cadets who looked it up in their iPhones to see what Agenda 21 was, and they were reading back to me the drivel that's spelled out there, and I asked them, did you not hear what I've spoken of the last 50 minutes? But anyway, it was interesting.
Yeah, I think some of these people just have their own ideas. They're locked in, and you're not going to be able to do much for them, frankly.
Yeah, they don't even ask questions. They're just pontificating and trying to show you how smart they are and,
right.
By comparison, how dumb you must be because you haven't made their exact points. And I ask, what is your question exactly? After 30 years of teaching, I know how to deal with space cadets. So.
I bet you had a few.
Yeah, I did.
You had a few in your day, I guess, like any other teacher. Well, at least you're ahead of the Communist Manifesto.
Yeah, I am, and I am in the paid section of the bestseller, so that's an encouragement.
Well, that is a good deal. Yeah, I like that. I know that we're always, the Communist Manifesto is the one that I've got in mind. We got to keep you ahead of that one.
I think my UN Agenda 21 environmental piracy book is still way better than the Communist Manifesto.
Well, not only is it doing better, but it is literally better.
literally better. Actually, this guy, Karl Marx, I did write about him in my first book, my autobiographical book, Echoes of Communism. He was a bum. He lived off his sponsor, Friedrich Engels, and he, espoused his ideas, and he neglected his family. He was a horrible father, husband, and individual in general. Some of his children died of malnutrition, they lived in absolute filth and squalor. You couldn't find a chair that had four legs that you could actually sit on. And we know some of this stuff because there was a Prussian spy sent to investigate him, but not because they were particularly interested in his ideas that were actually catching hold with all the ignoramuses of the time. But because he was married to the Prussian prime minister's daughter, and he was concerned about her welfare because she was living in such filth.
Oh, I see. Okay, so
he never combed his hair, never brushed his teeth, never had haircuts. Anyway, he was just the typical Occupy Wall Streeter from today, I would say.
Well, I've seen some of his pictures. He always looks the same in every picture I've seen. It's always that same, I guess, that same portrait of. I've never seen anything other than that. Than I guess his signature picture.
That was probably the only time he was presentable to be photographed.
But I mean, you know what? Which picture I'm talking about? The one that you see at all the marches and sort of his, I guess you might say, his signature. His signature picture, you know, with the beard and the hair, and he looks more like a 1960s rock and roller than anything else. So, or maybe the other way around, the rock and roller wanted to look like him, but not an attractive man, to say the least.
No, not at all.
Not a very groomed kind of guy. But anyway, we got a lot to get into. This week and lots of different topics to get into, but I did want to tell you that there's a cartoon that I saw, and then we'll get into the topics. There's a cartoon that I saw, and I'm going to send you, and it's this guy shoveling snow, really deep, you know, shoveling snow, and he's telling somebody that we had to cancel the global warming meeting because of the snowstorm, and when I saw that, I thought of you. So I'm going to find it and send it to you. Maybe you can put that.
Well,
maybe that's the,
it's
can be the
actually
cover.
True, because last Sunday they did meet in D.C. and it was the coldest day in a long time that we've had in D.C. It was 16 degrees Fahrenheit with a wind chill factor, and they were there to protest global warming and, of course, to persuade or force President Obama to stop the Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, I think that's Mother Nature having, I think Mother Nature is having, giving them a little attitude adjustment.
Yeah, every time. I think God is paying attention.
That's right.
He's sending all this horrible cold weather every time they meet.
That's right. I mean, it cannot be a coincidence that every time these clowns are going to have their big day, somehow global warming or they get a snowstorm. I know a couple years ago in Wisconsin, they were going to have a big celebration for global warming. I think they got this ice storm, and they literally had to cancel the meeting. But I think you're right. I think God's paying attention, and he's getting a little sick and tired of people who are trying to say that they have more power than he does. Don't you get that feeling?
Yeah, actually, they don't think so. They actually say it out loud. I have found many, many documents where they call themselves gods, that they can affect the planet, they can control the planet, and they're in charge.
Yes.
And I was just flabbergasted. It's all over the place. I've got, thick stacks of quotes from them.
I know. It is really incredible. Well, let's get into all the serious stuff. Pretty amazing week here in the United States, and I know you've got some articles that we want to get into that you've written as well. But I want to begin with just a couple of quick things. Interesting story that I sent you this week from Powerline, which is a great website out of Minnesota. Just a great website. They have great stuff. And this is about the increase that we've seen in food stamps going to people who are in the country illegally, which I find, it's one thing for food stamps for people who are here, citizens, it's not good to have an increase in food stamps, but at least if it's going to citizens or whatever, you can rationalize it. But when it's going to people who are not in the country legally, you have to wonder, A, is there a lack of control in the system? B, are we offering these benefits to people? It really hit me right between the eyes. What was your reaction?
Well, I'm not surprised because Mr. Hinderaker from the Powerline, I did read the article, has mentioned Jeff Sessions' Fox interview in which he said that he had requested information about the illegal immigration and the use of food stamps, and finally they responded to him, and he found out in the process that the number of people has quadrupled since 2001, with an estimated 1.7 million as of June 2012. And I do remember before I was allowed to become a legal immigrant, and I was called a resident alien, and I did not mind if that was the nomenclature. And one of the first things they asked and they was to make sure that I would not become a burden on the state, that I had means to support myself and to be able to in knowledge and training to employ myself. And now they're actually advertising on the Welcome to USA.gov page. They're advertising about the welfare benefits that new immigrants can receive. That is the number one talking point. And so as a result of that, they are actually recruiting indigent foreigners to come to the United States to receive welfare. And
right.
To me, that's outrageous.
No, that is outrageous. That is outrageous. I didn't mean to cut you off. I mean, were you going to say something else?
Yeah, I was going to say that Mr. Hinderaker also mentions that in Great Britain they're having a terrible problem because now the European Union has made a rule that beginning in 2014 there will be unrestricted immigration from Romania and Bulgaria. And Mr. Hinderaker says, well, I don't know why that is, but I can answer that. Why Romania and Bulgaria? Because a lot of gypsies, and I know that's politically incorrect term, they call themselves Roma now, but they come primarily from Romania and Bulgaria, and they go all over Europe, and they actually, through their various nefarious activities, they interfere with the tourism and industry in general in the EU nation. So because EU and Great Britain have been at odds over various issues ever since the establishment of the EU, they decided, well, let's just make you suffer more. So that is the answer why.
Yeah, so it's like a magnet. You know, these benefits are like a magnet. And what I
sure.
find interesting is that when I lived in Mexico for 4 years. I worked in Mexico for 4 years for an American company. And when I had to get my papers to go into Mexico to have a work visa, I remember having to prove to the Mexican government that I would not be a burden on Mexico, that I would be self-sustaining, and so on. And to me, when I went through this paperwork, and I did it right here at the consulate, at the Mexico consulate right here in Dallas, when I went through this paperwork, it seemed to me like a totally normal thing to ask. I mean, I was not offended by the fact that I had to provide a financial statement and references and so on. You know, they wanted to find out everything about me, and I said, hey, I'm going into your country. You have every right to do that. In other words, it didn't seem to me like something, extraordinary to be asking me. And,
well, that's true. And why recruit all these people, most of whom are illiterate? They're for sure going to go into the welfare roles. They can't read or write in their own language, much less in English. And we have 4 million visas already given, and they're waiting because the legal immigration has a number quota. And some of them have waited for 20 years. And these people are educated people who can actually support themselves and can actually contribute to society. We are a nation of immigrants, but we should do it legally. And amnestying however many, 11 million people that President Obama wants to amnesty and putting them at the head of the line is wrong. They should
right.
go at the back of the line and have certain restrictions. They can't vote for an X number of years. They have to integrate into society. They have to learn to speak English for the benefit of the rest of us and for the benefit of themselves, economically speaking, because if you do integrate into society, or you do better economically and otherwise.
Right. No, you're exactly right. And I don't think it should be a path to citizenship, and I've argued this, I think we mentioned it last week, it should not be a path to citizenship. It should be a path to some kind of legalization. I don't have a problem, you know, with some of them being able to work here or whatever, but citizenship, I think, is a very precious thing, and that should only be provided to people who have done it correctly from the very beginning. So I do take issue with those who want to have a path to citizenship. I do not subscribe to that. I think, as I said, legalizing some of them through a very, you know, through a process of a criminal background check and paying fines and all that's different. But
well, how can you be a good citizen if you don't understand the Constitution? You can't read the language of the country. You can't speak it. You can't read the traffic signs. You can't read anything. You can't really contribute to society. You don't want to be integrated. You form your little barrios from which you don't want to come out of because you have the assured welfare. And so we're really building up a situation like they have in London,
right,
where it is now called Londonistan.
Right.
There are certain areas where you don't go into, and it's a similar situation in France. In Marseille, for example, it's been almost totally taken over. It's horrible, and it used to be a beautiful, enlightened city.
Right. No, and this is the danger, and you're exactly right. And I think to some extent we see some of that in L.A., where you have, you know, a very significant Mexican section where, you know, you don't even need to speak English. I mean, you can just literally do everything in Spanish. The only problem is if you leave, I mean, if you don't speak English, how in the heck can you take a train and go somewhere else?
Well, and it's also offensive when they wave the flags of their countries and they, at the same time, trample or burn or deface the American flag. To me, you're not a good citizen. You're not a good candidate to become a citizen if you do that. That's just my opinion.
No, you're exactly right. I got angry a couple of years ago. I got angry. There was a game between Mexico and the United States, a soccer game. Now, for many Mexicans, that's a very passionate sport, and I understand that. I understand that part. It's a very passionate sport, and you know, they really get excited about soccer, which is fine. I mean, I get excited about other sports, so that's fine. But when you have the United States and you have Mexico playing in the United States, and you have people who are here basically cheering against the United States, it just kind of makes me wonder, you know, wait a minute, where are you? I mean, what side of the border do you really want to be in? I mean, do you want to
exactly.
be over here? I mean, do you want to be over here when it comes
anthem?
To? Yeah, I mean, do you want to be over here on payday, but you want to be the rest of the? Your mind is on the other. I mean, you got to make up your mind. I guess that's what I'm saying. You know,
exactly.
Where you want to be, and that. So that's you know, that's another thing. But that I think happens when you don't require people to learn the language of the country, and that's what's happening in Europe, where you have these entire communities of people who don't speak French or English or Dutch or whatever the language of the country is, right? I think that's what's happening.
Yeah,
over
and
there.
It's so bad. They're so lavish with their welfare. A new arrival, let's say from Africa, they blow through their 4,000 pounds a month that they get in welfare in 2 weeks. They can actually go back to the welfare system bureau, I forgot what it's called, and tell them, oh, we just ran out of help, of money, and they give them more.
Right. No, I know. It is.
No questions asked, and nobody dares to go into the areas to check where they live because they're afraid.
No, you're exactly right. And then when they don't like, they burn automobiles.
Exactly. The
like
youth. Yeah, and it's reported as youth, angry
right,
youth.
Right,
you
have,
well,
yeah,
okay.
some young people just having a little fun. You know, they're burning
right.
automobiles. In Paris. So, yeah, I know this is a big, I mean, we should be looking at Europe. And
yeah, that is our future, actually, and people are not paying attention because they say, well, it's not never going to happen here. Well, it is happening.
No, you're exactly right. It is happening. We're not there yet, but we're headed that way unless we make a big, big, you know, correction sometime very soon. There is a point of no, I mean, there's a point that once we cross, we're almost there. But hopefully we're still on this side of the border, and hopefully we can prevent it from getting that bad. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. Then after the break, I want to get into a couple of your articles. I want to talk about Obamacare this week, some of the interesting information coming out of Obamacare. I had sent you some article. Also, Robert Samuelson, Professor Samuelson, wrote a very interesting article. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about the minimum wage and exactly you know, how does the minimum wage impact a country? Because the minimum wage is one of those issues that gets into the political language, and it kind of sounds real good, but it also has a very negative impact on the economy, and particularly young people. So we're going to take a little break, and we will be right back. We're going to hear from our sponsor, Cubanos in Wisconsin, my book. Well, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, February the 22nd. Cubanos in Wisconsin is a book that it's a project that I began a couple of years ago. The title actually is a little bit older than a couple of years ago, but the whole idea was that I wanted to tell, I wanted to tell the world about our family and how we came to the United States. Not that our trip was heroic or anything like that, but I felt that we were driven by our desire to come here because of a family values and freedom, and our parents wanted us to grow up in a free country so that we wouldn't have to endure some of the things about communism that Dr. Johnson was talking about a few minutes ago. And in the process of writing this book, I began to realize that there was a real need for me telling my sons, you know, about where we came from. They knew a few things about our family story. Obviously, they had picked them up from just family chats. But through the book, they were able to learn a great deal. And I had the great pleasure of having our son, our number two son, who's now a first-year student at law school, and that's my son, Gabriel. And he helped me a great deal with some of the research and some of the, you know, some of the alignment of the book and that kind of thing, some of the styling and of the book. And it was very helpful. So it was a great honor for me to write the book with my son. But then once I really got into it, and now that the book is out there and I'm hearing from people who've read it, I'm beginning to realize that there was a need for this book so that we can get grandparents and grandchildren not just talking about Cuba, but talking about why they came here. And I'm finding that that's one of the big benefits of having written this book. And I've got grandparents and grandchildren talking about freedom and the Cuban history, and I think that's something that I'm very proud of. But anyways, I said before, the book's available in print, the book's available in Kindle. I happen to be one of those people who likes print because I like to hold it, I like to mark it, but, you know, a lot of people like the Kindle, and that's okay too. But anyway, you can get it. I have a link on the show information, or you can just go to the website Cubanos in Wisconsin, and you can get it for yourself. But as I said, I'm getting good reviews, and I'm very, very happy with the book. Let's get back to Dr. Ileana Johnson Poe. And many of the I bet some of the experiences that I had, maybe not exactly the same, but somewhat similar to some of your experiences.
I think so, yes, they were. And I've read your book, and I'm almost done with the review. We did have similar experiences, although you came from an island and I came from Europe. And because when you have socialism / communism, you have a socialist economy and a communist ideology, you pretty much have the same shared experiences, where you have the same shared misery and poverty and the same security police watching you and things like that. So
right. And this is something that I've learned from talking to other people who came from communist countries. You know, in Cuba, they were called the Committees for the Defense of the Revolution, and they were basically neighborhood people that would spy on their neighbors.
Exactly.
And so, I mean, this is an idea that, I mean, Castro didn't come up with this. He got it from the other Soviet countries, I'm sure.
Well, they got it actually from Karl Marx. He sat down and all the time and came up with academic ideas, and his ideas wrecked and transform half of the planet into communist societies. And Americans don't understand really the difference between communism and socialism, because they say, what's wrong with socialism? What's wrong with communism? And it's true, we do have some socialist forms of governing here in the United States. And, of course, there's socialism in the European Union countries, not all of them, but the majority of them. But the Americans make the failed mistake of not realizing that communism is a political system, where socialism, if you like, is primarily an economic system that can exist in various forms under a very wide range of political system. And Americans don't understand that. And I hope someday I can do a radio show soon where I can explain that, maybe in 10, 15 minutes, what is the basic difference.
Well, let me know when, and we'll do it. we'll do a show along. I mean, that's a great topic.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff wrong that's wrong with socialism and communism. So when somebody asks me, well, what's wrong, I ask them, well, how much time do you have?
Right.
And I can give you the condensed version or I can give you the expanded version.
That's right. Well, I think for most people, they see the two. Communism, they always associate that with a dictatorship. And socialism, they figured, well, people vote for it. But I think that's how a lot of people look at it. They say, well, you know, like the welfare state in Europe was brought about by people voting for it. I think that's maybe how they see the difference. But I promise you, we'll do a radio show on that topic because that sounds like a great topic. But let's get into. I know you've got a couple of articles that you want to talk about. But let's get into healthcare here in the United States and Obamacare. I found this article to be very interesting, and I sent you this one about the states are starting to worry about the cost of healthcare. And let me just kind of paraphrase. This article says higher premiums, talking about higher premiums at the state level, could undermine a core promise of the Affordable Care Act, the idea that health protections available to all Americans would be less than what they have now. And this is coming in states, this is out of the LA Times in California. So it's really starting this whole question of affordability is really starting to become a political issue. And quote, this is from very quickly here from, a lady by the name of Jill Zorn, Z-O-R-N, Senior Program Officer at the Universal Healthcare Foundation of Connecticut, a consumer advocacy group that supported the law, says, quote, the single biggest issue we face now is affordability. Well, I thought it was the Affordable Act. I mean, you follow what I'm saying?
I actually wrote an article that just went viral this week. It's called The Affordable Care Act Nobody Can Afford.
Right,
and
right.
I did a lot of research. So it went viral, you know, thousands and thousands of people. It's now circulating all over the Internet. But, yeah, it's nobody can actually afford this Affordable Care Act. So it was kind of misnamed, unfortunately named. And the reason is because it's been sitting in some drawer for 40 years collecting dust. And everybody's been excited about passing it. I remember Mrs. Clinton tried when her husband was president, and it didn't fly. And now that we have our first black president, oh, here's our opportunity. And, of course, it passed. And that is why nobody read the 2,700-plus pages. And now they're really, really upset when they find out all these taxes that were hidden in and all this force, well-armed force that's supposed to, quote-unquote, help with potential pandemics.
Right.
And the huge sales tax that nobody knew about. So nobody really read this bill. They just took it out of the drawer. Let's pass it. Let's twist some arms in the middle of the night. Let's bribe some people, and we'll pass it on Christmas.
Right. No, exactly. This is truly amazing. And I'm just going to read this again. I don't want to burden the listener with this, but to me, this is one of the greatest quotes in the history of mankind. Quote, the single biggest issue we face now is affordability, unquote. This is, I don't know. I mean, it's almost like, this is like the, I don't know, I hate to use this analogy. I hope nobody gets offended, but this is like the woman who has a wedding dress when she's like 16 years old. She buys a wedding dress for when she gets married. And then when she gets married, the wedding dress doesn't fit her. Maybe that's not a good example, but you know what I mean. I mean, I think you're exactly right. They had this bill in. This was a dream, an idea, and they had it in there, and they passed it without discussing it, and now we're finding out the single biggest issue we face now is affordability. My goodness.
Well, didn't Nancy Pelosi say you have to pass it to find out what's in it? And the president promised that it would reduce our insurance bills per family by $2,500 a year. Well, not so fast.
No, not so fast. Again, I just love this quote. I love this quote so much that I think I'm going to put it on. I think, I don't know, if I win the lottery, I think I'm going to put this quote on billboards across the whole country. the single biggest issue we now face is affordability. I thought it was supposed to be affordable. I thought that's why we passed it. But let me ask you another question, and then we'll get to your articles. I know you wrote, you've got a couple of that you want to talk about. The minimum wage. This is, I'm sure, an issue that, or something you taught when you were teaching economics. And the minimum wage is really something that sounds real good. I mean, you say to people, let's increase the minimum wage, and everybody goes, yeah, let's do that. What's wrong? I mean, everybody assumes it's only, it's only whatever, and therefore it's only a little bit, and therefore it's not going to mean anything. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. And over the years, what the increases in the minimum wage have done here in the United States is that they've really gone after youth unemployment. I mean, the young people are the ones who usually suffer the most because they're usually the ones that take, you know, these entry-level jobs or, you know, whatever. And so let's talk about that, because all of a sudden President Obama is proposing an increase in the minimum wage, but again, it's like everything he proposes, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, true. Well, the minimum wage was established as a stopgap, a temporary way of employment, so you would have some money coming in before you had all these welfare programs that were supporting you until you died in the nanny state. So it was just a stopgap. It was not meant to make a lifelong career out of it. It was just an incentive for you to train better and go to school and get out of that situation. Well, every time you increase minimum wage, of course, it's going to create more unemployment among those who are seeking minimum wage jobs, because employers are not stupid and they're there to make a profit in order to stay in business. So they will actually hire less part-time people, and they will give those who are full-time more hours or extra duties in order to make up for the shortage. So potentially, well, for a long, long time, unemployment minimum wage has caused more unemployment, and certain groups in society, particularly young groups, as you said, 15-year-olds or so, have experienced higher unemployment, but never so high as now. They're close to 50% because they're now competing with illegal aliens who take these minimum wage jobs, no questions asked, because they don't speak English. And they're just glad to have them because they, even at the current rate, they pay way higher than they do in their own countries. And which, incidentally, it's interesting because in Mexico, the unemployment rate is 4.7%. So to me, economically speaking, they should be going back because they would have better opportunities of employment there. But they don't have the welfare system that we do in this country. So.
No, you're right. Actually, you're exactly right. The Mexican economy is actually doing quite well at the moment. And there's no reason for these people to come here. The Mexican economy is doing well. But I just thought, you know, I remember a couple of years ago I had a guest on our show. We've had him on a couple of times. His name is Mr. Merrill Matthews. And he writes for, this article is out of Forbes that I sent to you, but he works here in the Dallas area for the Institute.
I loved his article, and there's one point that I liked was about the robotics part.
Yeah, but I just wanted to say he's a resident scholar at the Institute for Policy Innovation, which is right here in Dallas, and I've had him on the show a couple of times. He's an extremely busy guy, and getting him on the show is, you know, you have to book him like months ahead of time. He's just a very busy guy, you know, so I understand that. It was a real treat to have him on the show one time. But I like this, and I don't want to just read from articles today, but for some reason we've got some good ones today, that he says, quote, "The vast majority of studies assessing the impact of the increase in the minimum wage conclude that it hurts job prospects for young, low-skilled workers," just like what you said, "and it disproportionately affects young minority workers," which is exactly what you said. And, you know, so here we are. On one hand, we're saying we care about people, but on the other hand, we're forcing policies that actually end up hurting people. I mean, what kind of a government is that?
Yeah, it's true. And this arbitrary number that our president came up with, increasing it to $9, that's fine. but that's going to put the current minimum wage person into an entirely different income tax bracket because they're getting a 25% increase, and that's going to have implication with the Obamacare costs and what the employer will have to provide. So that's further going to make the employer think twice before they actually hire more people. They will actually lay off more people. So it's not good. But I like what Mr. Matthews said, that it might persuade employers to switch from human labor to an automated labor. And he quotes this a robot named Baxter from Rethink Robotics, who can do a lot of repetitive manufacturing work and only cost $22,000. And Mr. Matthews says once, and I'm sure they don't want vacation and they don't want time off and all that stuff.
Right. No,
and
you're right.
They don't have to buy medical insurance for the robot. So that was an interesting
article.
When
they break down, they just throw them away or they put a new screw in. Or whatever, but I thought Mr. Matthews had a great line too, and then we'll get to your article. He's talking about saying that they, and I'm paraphrasing right now, he says that employers are no different than anybody else. They have to make rational decisions. So if you increase the price of coffee 50%, well, probably people won't drink as much coffee. If you increase the price of gasoline 50%, we probably won't, drive as much. And if you increase the cost of employment 50%, maybe they're not going to hire as many people. They'll hire robots. And I'll give you one personal experience. When I first came to the United States in the late 60s, most places that you put gasoline in, you had basically kids who would – those were great jobs back then for college kids and just kids in general. You could work at the gas station pumping gas, and, this little nice lady would come in and you pump the gas and you check your oil and check the tires, and this little grandmother would give you a quarter tip. And that was great, that was a great job. You could make, $5 or $6 on a weekend, in tips, which is, it was a big deal. Everywhere you go now, you got a machine to pump gas. And I've got to believe there's a connection between that and minimum wage. Maybe it's not exact, but there probably is.
Well, automation did replace, of course, a lot of low-skilled labor. I agree. But you got to go to New Jersey. I think in New Jersey it's still the law that you cannot pump your own gas, which I kind of like that. But it's for different reasons. They don't want accidents to happen.
Oh, okay.
People pumping incorrectly and catching on fire and stuff like that.
Oh, you mean like the guy who goes to the gas station, he's smoking a cigarette while he's pumping
gas? Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, there are some low-information voters who put gas in their car, so maybe we got to protect. All right, well,
I got to tell you a story about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you go to Europe, they have this very popular chocolate egg that has a toy inside, and everybody loves it. They're Kinder eggs meant for children, and they have never had problems in Europe. The kids eat the little chocolate on the exterior, and then they assemble the toys. Well, they brought them in the United States to New York, of course, and some idiotic parent gave it to their two-year-old, who proceeded to swallow the parts of the toy inside, and there was a big lawsuit, and those eggs are banned in the United States. So that's low-information voters for you. I mean, who gives little pieces like that to a two-year-old?
No, you're right, but it is really amazing to me. Every once in a while, it doesn't happen a lot. I don't want to exaggerate this, but every once in a while, you go pump gas, and you're sitting there, and there's literally somebody smoking and pumping gas, and you feel like saying, "Sir, don't you read?"
Yeah, I try to drive off and just go to a different pump
station.
Another interesting story.
Yeah.
Speaking of low-information voters, my husband and I and our youngest daughter went to Italy, and we actually went to a horse meat restaurant. It was in northern Italy. And, of course, I didn't eat horse meat, but that's not the point of the story. They had these slabs of a type of lava rock that held heat for a long, long time. And you chose the cut of meat you wanted, and you cooked it yourself on this lava rock right there. And I could see around, little kids, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and nobody was burned. Everybody was fine. And if they were here in the United States, there would be people screaming left and right, you know, being burned and lawsuits. And yet Italians didn't do that because they're not a litigious society like we are.
Right. And again, the story about the lady who went into McDonald's and is driving, drinking coffee, I guess, and gets burned and decides to sue McDonald's. I never quite understood that. You're not supposed to drive and drink coffee at the same time. But anyway, now I'm going to be quiet and I'm going to give you 5 minutes to tell me about your article.
Well, the most popular one that I wrote this week is the Affordable Care Act that nobody can afford, and I urge everybody to go to Canada Free Press and read it. But I do have a news break. It just broke about 5 minutes ago. Still about Obamacare. This type is Obamacare cronyism. Apparently, there's a New York-based freelancers insurance company that has been rated the worst insurer for two straight years by state regulators, and data compiled by a National Insurance Association show as being an extremely high rate of consumer complaints. Well, this particular New York-based insurance company received $340 million in federal loans to establish the Obamacare co-ops in New York, New Jersey, and Oregon. The information just broke from the WashingtonExaminer.com. Well, this organization established had a freelancers union, a nonprofit organization that described itself as offering, quote, health insurance and other benefits plus advocacy, solidarity, and resources for freelancer and independent workers. So is this meant for healthcare or is this street organizing? So it was kind of upsetting to see this. The funds are awarded tax-free loans by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Center for Consumer Insurance Information and Oversight. So here we are, you know, some more cronyism, while the rest of the country, you know, have to deal with all these increased costs. And I just went to the doctor recently, and I was presented again with a little freesia. It's called Phreesia computer tablet, in which you have to update your information, and supposedly the doctor receives their insurance payments quicker. But when I came to the page where it's asking me to give permission for them to access all my history of medications I've ever bought at the pharmacy, and my information, medical history, will be released to a third party, I said no, because it was you had option no or yes. Well, when I said no, the computer stopped. So I asked the lady at the desk why. She said, well, you can decline, but we'll refuse you medical care. I said, well, what if I pay you cash? Well, same difference. So thanks, Obamacare, for taking my ability away to see a doctor. And thanks for the doctors now, since they've become all these co-op and mergers, are refusing medical care,
right?
Because you have to comply with the Obamacare regulation. So
right,
it's
this,
all in my
No, go ahead.
Article.
Go ahead. No, but this is why it's the Affordable Care Act that nobody can afford.
Exactly. And
exactly,
the cheapest plan we discussed last week is $20,000 per year. I have never paid for my entire family $20,000 a year insurance.
No.
I think the most, even as a retired person, was $8,000 a year premium.
Right.
And it only pays 60% of medical costs.
Right. No,
after
you're exactly
a huge
right.
deductible, I think the deductible is like $12,000 per family. Who has $12,000 per, you know, the average family making $40,000 a year to pay in deductible first before
right.
they even start beginning to pay for
no,
you?
No, you're right. And this is why, you know, I think the title of your article was so, I mean, so I'm going to use a baseball analogy. If you, I mean, it's like hit it out of the park, you know. I know that. Do you understand what that means, right?
Yes,
now?
Yes, of course I do.
Okay.
And,
now you do. Now, when you first came here, you
now
didn't.
Now I do. I understand.
Now you do. Okay. Well,
yeah.
So you hit it out of the park with that title, you know, the Affordable Care Act that no one can afford. That's exactly what it is. I mean, this thing, it's funny on one hand, but really sad on the other, because a lot of good people are going to get hurt. And I just think this is, I mean, I heard, and then we'll close with this thought, but The Attorney General of Virginia the other day said something, and I'm paraphrasing him, but he said something that this Obamacare is going to be like a bunch of train wrecks. You know, one train wreck and then another train wreck. You know, it's a train wreck. You put the train back on track and then another train wreck. And that's what it is. I mean, there was one article that I sent you we didn't have a chance to get to, and that's Universal Theme Park. I guess this is the place where people go for entertainment, I guess. Theme Park. I don't know where they are, but I think they have more than one location. They're going to quit.
Orlando, yeah.
Yeah, they're going to quit offering insurance to part-timers, I guess.
Well, it was a really kind of mini insurance. It wasn't really worth having because it only paid $5,000 a year. But I do want to make two quick points before we have to go. There's going to be a tremendous rate shock for young and the healthy Obamacare supporters because it imposes what is called a community rating on insurance companies, effectively forcing them to charge the young and the healthy more so that they can charge older and sicker consumers less. And so what are young people going to do? They're not going to buy insurance, and they would only buy it whenever they have to go to the hospital when they get sick. And the other point that I want to make, it also has to do with the Obamacare and the 21 new taxes. The biggest one of that is the sales tax on purchasing the health insurance, which will total in the next 10 years $101.7 billion. So starting next year, the Not-So-Affordable Care Act imposes a new $100 billion tax on health insurance. And the tax will start at $8 billion in 2014, then it will go to $14.3 billion in 2018, and of course it will increase after that constantly. So that's why I said this is a the Non-Affordable Care Act.
Right. Or the Affordable Health Care Act that no one can afford.
Exactly.
Something like that, right? No, you're exactly right. And it's really tragic. I mean, we're having fun with it, but at the same time, as I say, and there's a lot of people who are just getting hit between the eyes because it's coming. And, in fact, another article that we didn't have a chance to get to, in the city of Los Angeles, I think, or one of the major cities, was basically one of the insurance plans was already going broke or something like that, or something along those lines. So there's going to be a lot of affordability issues with the affordable haircut.
Well, of course, and they've ended the insurance for those who had pre-existing conditions this week because the fund ran out of money, and the Obamacare is not even in full force, and they've already run out of money. And what's going to happen, there's going to be such an enrollment decline that they will not have the money to support the added 40 million or so of people to the insurance pool. We've seen this in 8 states that have had similar type of insurance, and they had to end up dropping the reforms or loosening the rules because they needed people to come back into the pool because the premiums for the people who were left in the pool kept climbing and climbing to unreachable heights.
Right. But see, this is why I said at the top of the show that I wish I had taken your economics class, because then I would have been a lot smarter. I would.
Thank you, Sylvia. You're sweet. Next time.
You have a great weekend, and thank you so much for your input, Dr. Ileana Johnson-Poe. Well, that's going to do it, folks. The Affordable Health Care Act that no one can afford. I love that. I love that line. We're going to link to that article later in Facebook. Everybody, have a great weekend. This is Sylvia Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.